black hole spins. And again, I don't want to make it a formal talk, really. I just hope it's a discussion. So I put few, it looks formal, but I'm going to switch to very informal slides, even from just what I just prepared yesterday. So I'm going to skip all the introduction about modeling, what I do in population synthesis, but let's go jump directly to black hole spins. And to, so we're going to skip that. But I have this just for the support if you have, you know, questions about the results. So I can go back and show the modeling. But let's just, instead of spending half an hour on introduction, let's just go directly to spins. Okay? So let's start with the spin magnitude, okay, for black holes.
And I'll be,
yeah, I was here at 7 a.m.
You only wrote that from 7 to 9.
Yeah, but that's important. That's how important it is. So just so we can have this on a spin definition on the board, modulo C and G, it's like, you know, angular momentum divided by mass of the black hole to the power of 2, okay? So let's to LIGO doesn't measure that, measure something else, but I'll come back to that. Let's see how we can actually estimate that VET models. So what we do is shown on that figure. It shows pretty much few evolutionary models from MESA and from Geneva with different mechanisms for angular momentum transport. So you start with some rotation of the star. You put some unknown, really, because we have no good constraints for that, although some of you may disagree with that, so we can talk about this. I will be provocative, so stop me anytime you want. But we put some angular momentum transport mechanisms, and when you follow the evolution of a star, those models go to end of a core helium burning, and then you look through at a profile of angular momentum, specific angular momentum through the star, through the mass of a star. So that's what it shows. Let's just pick one line, either red or purple, those are MESA models with Tyler-Sprout magnetic dynamo. So it's a star almost rotates like a, you know, solid body, stiff body, and it transports very efficiently angular momentum to the surface when it gets blown away with the stellar winds. All those models are done for 30, just one, I will show you entire grid, but I want to explain this on one model. So it's a 32 solar mass star, which will produce about, you know, 5 to 10 solar mass black hole, depending on what prescription do you use. Low metallicity, about 10%. And that's what you see. So this is a mass from zero, that's the center of the star. At 12 masses, you have a helium core, that's edge of helium core, and then you have the rest of the star, okay?
So Chris, question, so for the dynamo, what's the assumption of the Frank-Planck field that would play a role, and then you assume that it would go all the way to the repartition or something?
Would you help?
In these dynamo models, the assumption is you start with a weak field that gets wound up, and then it reaches, then there's an instability, and it reaches some saturated state where the magnitude of the field is self-regulating. So that can happen as long as you start with a weak field. If you start with a strong field, you might get even more efficient angular momentum.
Yeah, and I will come back to that. I don't call it a Fuller model. So we're
my model doesn't start with a stronger field. It's just a different saturation.
Different saturation, yes, yes. So, but we'll come back to that. But for now, those are only standard MESA and standard Geneva models. So let's just look at those two. Those are MESA models with the standard Tyler-Sprout dynamo. And you see the angular momentum just goes up and then stays flat for the rest of the star. So what we do, how we actually estimate that, we take, you know, in binary evolution, you lose pretty much entire envelope when you have two fluffy stars, they lose envelopes, and helium cores collapse to black holes. You may have some mass loss or may not have some mass loss, but pretty much, you know, you collapse that angular momentum to get that A. So you have a mass of black hole, that's a mass of a very proxy, I'm making some shortcuts, mass of a helium core squared, and you have that, you calculate how much angular momentum you have, okay? And that you get A. Now, so that's one thing. That's how we do. And we run a bunch of models of different masses, from neutron star formation regime all the way to over 100 solar masses, different metallicities from over solar to very, to like below 1% solar. And we combine that into entire universe and we produce all those black holes in different combinations, and we check what we detect. But I will come back, and then we can actually present detectable predicted distributions and compare them against LIGO, which I'm going to do in a few slides. But let's talk about this. So,
about this another question. So depending on the density profile of the what you're going to call the core, you might then form a black hole and have further mass injected.
Yes, you can. And this is always a big question. For now, for most of my models, I assume that the massive stars, like above 40 solar masses, are so dense, the layers, silicon oxygen layers are so dense that you collapse everything into a black hole.
Okay. You're going to
at that mass, at 32, you would lose, I would have a weak supernova and would eject some would leave the system, and some would fall back. So, but of course, this is just model dependent. We really don't know. We haven't seen a black hole we haven't seen a formation of a black hole yet, really. Or maybe we have seen it, but we cannot prove it.
So if the envelope is thrown off, then what you're saying now is essentially this will be an upper limit on the spin.
Yeah. Okay. So what we actually, to take care of what you just said, and it's not my device, but Chris, so I won't be able to define the number. When I will be calculating effective spin, when I need that black hole spin, we don't usually use that. We do something slightly different. We say that spin of a black hole is minimum of what I have calculated from Sperrer model and 0.85. Maximum spin is 1, so we just say there's always some angular momentum loss at supernova. Whether it's 0.9, 0.95, we don't know. But for those models that I will show you, Chris Fryer just used that number, but it's 0.9, 0.8, doesn't matter. So pretty much when you see 0.85, it's a maximally spinning black hole, okay? But we don't really know. There's a lot of uncertainties like that when we will go.
Sorry, what's the reason for that again? Because a lot of these are going to have very large spin, right? Especially these top ones. So.
Well, wait a second. No. I will come to the values in a second. I don't know. I mean, if you have supernova explosion, you may lose some of that mass. So then you don't keep all the spin that I just showed you.
It's specific angular momentum that
yes.
matters. Mm-hmm. So losing mass is not a problem. So
well, but if you have a lot of angular momentum in the outer layers, then you lose angular momentum as well. Of a core.
But as you can see from your formula, the curve parameter depends on the specific angular momentum per unit mass.
I think so, but
The outer layers have more specific angular
momentum than the center.
Oh,
yeah.
I see. Okay.
Yeah.
So that's the reason for
it. But you know, whether you use it or not, you know, it's really taken out of the blue. So we simply don't know. But there should be some study of that, of course. But since we don't know how black holes really form, do they explode, or is there an explosion for those most massive ones? Or remember, guys, when in Ohio they were looking for stars that disappear totally, they found one. Is it right? They found one star about 24 solar masses that just disappeared. But the thing is, it's not a definitive proof of a black hole formation, because there are so-called Myra variables that are also bright, and they have such a big pulsation that when they shrink, they can also disappear. For like 10 to 20 years. So we need to wait another 10 years to make sure that it doesn't reappear, then we have a proof of black hole formation. Okay? So we don't really know. So, I mean, there's a lot of those, it's a good question. There's a lot of those assumptions that goes into those calculations. So actually, surprisingly, I'm always shocked when I get anything close to what is being observed when I go. Okay.
One other question, what's the size of the iron core?
In kilometers, I have no idea. It's
centimeters.
Okay.
Depends when you're talking about. But over 1500 when it starts collapsing. 1500 kilometers.
But I'm not showing iron core here. But I'm just showing by mass, because it's a mass unit. By mass, iron core is about 1-2 solar masses, somewhere here. So that's iron core. Okay, I know in masses. But thank you. Anyway, there are a couple of interesting things on this plot. It's messy. I haven't done that plot. I would put it into 4 plots. It's Rafael Hirschi. It's his models. But anyway, let me show you a couple of trends which are, I think, interesting in terms of actually understanding the physics, how we actually form those spins of black holes. Let's look at those two lines, which looks almost the same, at least up to the helium core is here. So it's a purple and red line. Those are two MESA models, both with tireless fluid dynamo, so efficient angular momentum loss, which we take away, but they have different rotation, initial rotation of a model. One model, which is slow rotation, that red line, we start at 100 kilometers per second. That's actually most of the masses of stars rotate at 100 kilometers per second. But there is a second peak at 400 kilometers per second when you look at observations in our galaxy. And that's that fast model. It's actually at 350 kilometers per second, doesn't matter. Okay, so we test two. We want to test how this black hole spin parameter will depend on the initial rotation of a star. So we take two peaks, okay?
This is the speed at the...
Speed at the zero equation sequence, when you form a star out of the collapse. At the surface of a star, correct. Yeah, but you know, star is assumed to rotate co-rotate at the beginning, so it's a pretty much a speed through, it's a surface kilometer, so, yeah. It's a surface, yes, yes. 40% critical, yeah.
Okay.
And it's a surface, yes.
When you say co-rotate, you mean uniform rotation?
At the beginning, yes, but then it changes with depending which, how you couple those zones, whether Tyler's fluid dynamo or meridional currents, okay? So look, we wouldn't expect that, you know, what you would expect that fast rotation has more angular momentum, so it will keep more. No. And this is a very simple explanation. When you have a slow rotating model, you don't have much angular momentum, you lose some, and you're left with some amount of angular momentum. When you have a fast model, you have more angular momentum, but then you have more dynamo action. So you lose more. And that actually happens to balance each other out, at least in those models, those MESA models. So that tells you that when you use that angular momentum transport, no matter what's your initial spin, you're getting some black hole spins for given metallicity and, you know, mass of the star. Okay? Now, so that's one observation, and you can make 10 of observations here. I'm going to do only one more, just to keep us on the... So actually, when you integrate that and calculate this, MESA spin would be, for that star, let's call it A MESA, about 0.1, small spin, okay? Both for fast and slow rotating models. Let's now go to line green and orange, and green and orange are Geneva, both slow rotating models, but they don't have Tyler's fluid dynamo. They have only very weakly those meridional currents in radiative zones that transport angular momentum, not very efficient, it's mild angular momentum transport. Of course, you see they produce a lot, much more angular momentum. That's about an order of magnitude. So of course, what you expect? You expect this to go, let's call it a Geneva. You expect one, although we keep it, you know, 0.85 or 0.9, whatever. But that's how we calculate that stuff. So can I move on, or are there any questions to that? Because
are there no observations of massive stars that can constrain these angular transport models?
So the only way to look into the massive star is astroseismology. Oh. And I checked last week, but Jim, correct me, the most massive star that astroseismology is being done, it's 9 solar masses. Okay. That's neutron star formation regime, not black hole. I want to be above 20, 30, really. Really, I want to see 100. Those massive stars have very kind of fluffy atmospheres, but it's hard to look at those various pulsation modes to probe the star. So I don't... Do I get it right?
So it's true. There are very few constraints on massive stars on interim rotation rates. Now, for low mass stars below a few solar masses, there are lots of astroseismic measurements. And what you find there is that basically none of these models shown work. The cores of low mass stars rotate slower than predicted by all these models, by about a factor of 10.
So are
some
of these neutron stars? I mean, you would use
those would all form
white dwarfs.
Yeah, 4, 5, 2, 3 solar masses.
What if I form a neutron star? I mean, we have plenty of measurements of neutron stars.
And that would be entire new talk, and I'm not going to even touch on neutron stars because I would have to pull entire new talk.
No,
so,
but you just mentioned that in the low mass stars they get it completely wrong. So how wrong or correct do they get it if you go?
But,
we're going to have a discussion about this later. I think roughly the Taylor Sprout would predict neutron star rotation periods of order 10, 20 milliseconds Lindbergorn. And the new prescription I developed is a bit slower, like 100 milliseconds.
And because of that, I will show one, which is not shown here, I will show one model that corresponds to his angular momentum transport that would explain those things. But I don't want to touch on neutron stars because it's opening a Pandora box here. Like, especially, like you pointed this out, for neutron stars, it's not only this process, how much angular momentum you have, but during a supernova, a lot can happen that doesn't connect to angular momentum of a star. So that's why I want to open, that's a different subject. It's true, we should have a given meeting on that.
It's a different subject, but from outside, I want to first understand where I can believe.
Yes, yes. So I'm not trying to convince you what to believe or not. I will, not yet. I will put this against observations, okay? And then you can make your own judgment. Okay. And I won't be pushing either way. So, anyway.
Sorry, should, perhaps you said this already, but what's the key difference in physics between MESA and Geneva?
Okay, so in MESA, you use magnetic fields to pretty much keep the star rotation almost like a solid body, almost. So like layers are coupled by magnetic field. Then you, therefore you transfer the momentum out to the surface very quickly and blow it away with the wind. So star slows down. For here, for Geneva model, we use no magnetic fields. And so there's no, so stars doesn't transport the momentum that efficiently. So it slows down much slower. So it keeps much more angular momentum in. So when, therefore, your black hole spin, instead of being 0.1, it's about 0.9 or even 1.
Okay, and then the curves agree pretty well compared to Mesa.
Yes, so you actually, when you use Mesa with no Tyler Sprout dynamo, you have an option, they almost the same. So both Mesa and Geneva agree. So at least that physics is coded in the same way in both codes. But whether either mechanics works, like Jim says, maybe there's other mechanisms. He proposed the third one. Maybe there's something completely different that we haven't thought about yet. But those are the options right now on the table. Those two plus Jim's, and I will show three, because I don't have...
Taylor Sprout leads to almost uniform rotation.
All, no, not there's fully all. No, it's not uniform rotation. It's
almost uniform on the main sequence. After the main sequence, a lot of departure rotation.
It happens.
What's the dash dot, the J10?
Details, doesn't matter. I will talk to you about this later, because we'll never finish.
Actually, it's kind of interesting, sorry, but it's kind of interesting because...
Okay, this one, blue one?
No, the one, the dash dot.
Okay, this one, yeah. I just rose those two lines by a factor of 10 to show that I changed specific angular momentum from 0.1 to 1. So this, I'm just showing an order of magnitude difference. I'm just showing that Geneva models or no Tyler Sprout dynamo models are about over an order of magnitude above when I use Tyler Sprout. That's it. They just up. That is important, blue one. But I don't want to. It's too many details on this plot.
Let me give you another question. So in these models, can you resolve with Mesa or with Geneva where the black hole grows?
No, they don't. You don't, with those codes, you don't do black holes. With those codes, you don't do black holes. You only go to some level, some stage of burning.
Oh,
you even, here, you don't even go to core collapse. You go to end of a core helium burning.
Okay, so then I'm going to ask the assumption. Is the assumption that the black hole forms at a different size or forms much smaller and then grows by
Let me tell you how we do that. We even make it much more simpler. We just say, I have some prescriptions from supernovae models that tell me, okay, I say entire helium core goes into black hole, and I say, bam, this is the edge of a helium core, I send all of this to black hole, modulo, few percent of emission of mass by neutrinos. And that fraction I change between 1 and 10% because I don't know what it is. I think it's on the level of 2, 3%. So all of that mass just goes into black hole with all the specific angular momentum. And I emit, few percent of mass by neutrinos.
Right.
That's it.
But then I was going to point out that the story can change completely if you assume that you form a small black hole that grows by accretion of its own.
Yes, of course. So here you assume, so I'm just telling you, here I'm assuming that I'm sending all that angular momentum that is shown on that figure into the thing. So you formed almost directly, let's put it that way. Yes, it would change the result. And for neutron stars, it's even more messy. Then, of course, you ask yourself, if you have some mass ejection, you have asymmetry, does that asymmetry only imparts the momentum kick, also a spin kick? No idea.
But you can check for the consistency of what you're just saying, though, because there is presumably some mass that collapses and forms a black hole, and there is some kind of envelope outside.
Well, not in binary. In my scenarios, there is no envelope. That was removed in binary evolution by binary interactions. The partner, the next star.
You're assuming that over mass, you mean all the stellar mass goes into the black hole?
Modulo neutrinos, modulo few percent.
It's not just the core of the mass of the star that.
No. For most massive ones, yes. For lower mass black holes, for this, I would assume few percent of baryonic mass loss. Yes. For that, I would assume. And that leaves the system. But for most massive black holes, that will be most important to us because LIGO sees mostly those massive ones. I assume that all the baryons goes in under the horizon.
But you can check whether that is a consistent assumption in the following way. If you form the black hole, you actually have an innermost stable orbit of that pretty much almost non-spinning black hole. And then you can go back and see whether the angular momentum that you had in the specific angular momentum was actually such that mass that was outside that innermost stable orbit will actually not go inside the black hole. So you can actually check at least in a post-processing.
I think that was Chris Fryer and Jean-Pierre Lasota did check that. And that was fine. Yeah.
So does the angular momentum go into the orbit of the companion? because you, all the mass goes into the black hole. Does the angular momentum not goes back to the orbit of the
No, it goes to the black hole.
But then you haven't got rid of the angular momentum, right? You just delay the accretion of angular momentum to the later stage.
I think what's happening basically is that you run your stellar model, and Chris is doing similar to what I do, is you just sort of assume the whole helium core, the star falls into the black hole. The hydrogen envelope, which absorbs most of the angular momentum of the star that's collapsing, gets ejected sometime during the life of the star, usually by an interaction, a binary interaction. So you have a common envelope, you strip the hydrogen envelope of the star, and that contains most of the original angular momentum
yeah.
of the star.
Can the removal be that efficient?
Yeah.
The hydrogen envelope? Yes.
Yeah,
so it depends how much of the helium core's angular momentum is absorbed by the hydrogen envelope before it's lost. And that's what these models tell you. Basically, how much of the helium core's angular momentum is transported into the hydrogen envelope before it's removed.
But at least in binary, over your question about angular momentum removal in binary, when you have a violent common envelope, dynamic interaction of two stars, you pretty much throw that envelope away. So at least people think we can remove the angular momentum that way.
And it's often lost by wind. It's not lost by
wind.
I'm going to quickly switch the slide, because we'll never stop.
Welcome to Broadbuster.
Yeah. I even didn't want to show that slide. Yeah. Yeah, sorry.
Of the system being like that. I mean, for example, if you look at CPs, you see most of the angular momentum is already lost.
Yeah, so if you look at white dwarfs that have gone through this process, they still tend to spin slowly. Unless they've started accreting again, in which case they can spin rapidly again.
Okay, so let's continue. Let's leave it close behind for now, because we'll never finish. Let's do this instead of one star, we'll do this for different mass of stars that form different mass of black holes, and let's do it for different metallicity, so I can use that for entire universe, so I can simulate like observations. So this is mass of a carbon-oxygen core just before the collapse. Before formation of iron core, but you can take it as a proxy for mass of a black hole on one plot and the other plot, and this is a spin of a black hole that it forms for two models, Geneva and Mesa, okay? And those are very different, just because of what I said. So for Geneva models, low-mass black holes tend to end the solar masses form with a high angular momentum, 0.85, 0.9, like I said. High-mass black holes, they actually, higher mass stars do, the 30, 50 solar mass black holes coming out of 100 solar mass stars, they do remove angular momentum even with it, without Tyler's Prout dynamo. They remove angular momentum. They have enough winds to actually take the entire envelope away from the star with angular momentum. So you either form a 10 to 20 solar mass black holes with a lot of spin, or you form high mass black holes with spins, 0.2, 0.1 in that regime. So that's one model. Okay. Second model, look at the range. This is from 0 to 1. I'm changing the range here, and this is very important. This is from 0 to 0.2. Pretty much MESA models are at 0.1, are all here, are all below what Geneva gives you, okay? I can explain all those differences, but we're not gonna do that. It would take 2 days. But it's about, 0.1. And now Jim comes in and says that Tyler's Prout dynamo works slightly differently, removes angular momentum more efficiently, and for his model, I would assume that each black hole, no matter what metallicity of star it comes from, no matter what mass of a star, it will have 0.01, almost zero spin. So it will be right here. So you see, you have Geneva with bimodal distribution of spins, then you have MESA, and then you have GIMS. Okay? Black hole spins. So those are three models I'm going to apply now.
Just out of curiosity, I mean, all these results, these investigations, they came after the LIGO detection. No, I'm asking because one of the vanilla arguments is like, black holes from the field should be maximally spinning because you spin up the stars and then form a spinning black hole. But it seems that if you do any calculation, that doesn't seem to be true.
So I will actually tell you about spinning up the stars. I'll show you the effect when you spin up the stars when you don't spin them up. Okay, so but to answer your question, those calculations, at least mine, came after LIGO began detecting black holes, and it was totally surprising to me that the spins are pretty much for all of them zero. So I will be comparing only to those 10 detections that we have from 01 and 02. There's 20 more, And I don't know what the spins are. So I can. Some of you probably from LIGO know that.
We have like 10 more from the.
No, 20 more. 20
more from the Princeton group on
one. Ah, so 20 from LIGO plus another 10. Yes. So you know you. But so I'll be only comparing against those 10, and for those 10 were small spins. So.
Yeah, but that's less astrophysics.
Yeah.
And are you also going to address the claims from X-ray binary analysis?
So that I can explain very easily. So this has a, most people don't know, but that explanation is out there. It's published, and it's so easy. Like this, just people think it's a conundrum here with high mass X-ray binaries, but it's very easy. But let me first show those results, because we'll never finish. Yeah. So, but look, imagine you have three models: one model, Geneva model, Mesa model, and I will call it Fuller models because I just switched the last name, okay? So because it'll be on the plots that show that way.
Okay. Yeah. And these are all effectively single star evolution models.
Yes, exactly. We'll come back to that. Yes. So I'll compare how this. I'm gonna take those. So this is the transition right now. I'm gonna take those models and put them in binaries, and pretty much say that if I have a star in binary, it will of a star of a given mass and metallicity, it will form me a black hole with that spin. Of course, there are caveats to that, and when I show you the results with those spins, I will show you how those caveats affect those results and what are those caveats. What binary version can do it differently for you in terms of black hole spin. But let's first look at the results so we at least get to them today. Okay? But we have those three models, and those are the first two results. So now I'm switching. I won't be discussing about black hole spin, individual spin. That's actually spin magnitude, is that right? I'll be talking about effective spin parameter that LIGO measures or estimates. Okay, all of you are familiar with that parameter, or should I go through the definition because it's actually important to understand? Should I go through it?
Go through.
Okay. So it's a combination of masses M1, M2. So those are two masses of black holes, and it's normalized by sum of merger mass. A1, A2 are black hole spin magnitudes, as we calculate that way. And cosines of theta 1 and theta 2 are an inclination angle between binary angular momentum and black hole spin. Okay? So in all my simulation, I assume that assumption could be already questioned. I assume that at zero time sequence, when I form two stars in binary out of a cloud, that this is binary orbit, angular momentum is perpendicular to binary orbit, and two stars that form L1, L2, they spin. But perfectly aligned, so those are, you know, cosines are one, so they disappear, okay? Mm-hmm. This is true or not, there's observation showing that this is not the case. But that would be a huge complication. Let's stay with this way, okay? So that parameter goes from minus one to one. When I have that situation and those spins, A1 and A2, magnitudes are one maximal, then that value is plus one. If I flip those two spins down, and they're still maximally rotating, it's minus one. So that's the entire range, minus one to one. When it's zero, like LIGO is observing, you only have three options. To make that effective spin zero, like for LIGO observations, you either put both spins on orbital plane, because then cosines are zero, okay? Since the masses are similar for most of those LIGO events, you keep one, and you flip the other one, okay? Or what you do, you make those spin magnitudes close to zero because you cannot make money. So there are only three options to explain LIGO observations. So far, there are physical models behind two options. Nobody proposed anything for to do this, to keep one back on line. But people claim that causal lead-off effect, when you have a trier companion, can, you know, will modulate the orbit, not really black hole spins, but modulate the orbit. So effectively, you're moving the spins, and when you put them on the orbital plane, the merger emission of gravitational waves is more effective because the system is more eccentric, and you tend to merge when the two spins are in. So there is a mechanism here. The mechanism I want to discuss mechanism which makes black hole spins small. Okay? So that's a full picture at the moment. Okay? So now let's look at LIGO observations versus the models that I showed you. So this shows, so on that horizontal axis, I show effective spin parameter from minus one to plus one on both plots. And here I show, well, let's first look at the blue signs. Those are the 10.01.02 detections. Midpoints of estimate and error bars. Most of them pretty much are almost, but that one are consistent with effective spin being zero. Some are negative, some are positive. I want to go into the distribution. I'll be trying to get the range of those spins. Those lines, two lines, are my models. Red and so this is my standard evolutionary model. When I put the Geneva black hole spins, I just gave two different natal kicks to black holes. One model, the red model, has almost no kicks, so I don't make those angles big. Some of them get a bit of a kick, but not much. But the second model, I give them full neutron star kicks. I kick them as much as I can without breaking. I'm already kind of breaking astrophysical constraints, but I'm giving them. So I would still could try to convince people that maybe it works, because then I would try to misalign them. So you see, that's the model with magenta line, full black hole kicks. This is logarithmic scale. This is weighted, but my models are weighted by detection. So this is what you already should see. You see that for both models, you have a huge peak at 0.8, 0.9, spin 0.8, 0.9. Those are 10 to 20 solar black holes that I produce the most that have large spins, 0.9, 0.8. And okay, you misalign some of them, and you go cross zero, even go to negative values. Sometimes they both happen to. It's really.
But peak at 0.85 is because of the assumption.
Yes, exactly. But if I use 0.95 here, you would move even farther. Yeah, yeah. This is just simple assumption. But the thing is, it's clearly inconsistent with the LIGO data.
Can you say a word about how you populate the universe?
Okay. So what I do, I'm doing right now for these models only population 1, population 2 stars. So I go out to redshift 15. I talk to Pierre Amadou, people like him, and I take star formation rate density across that age. So I populate universe with as much stars. You know, it's rising to redshift 2, then drops down right now to present. I also take all the metallicity measurements from GRB supernovae for chemical evolution models, and I populate, because metallicity will really affect black hole masses and also therefore black hole spins. So I populate at each redshift bin, my redshift bin are 0.1, populate, I know how much mass, I know metallicity distribution in that bin, I populate that, and then I evolve binaries and single stars, and I see which binaries survive, and some of them will form black holes at redshift 10, and then I will see if that will merge within LIGO horizon, and current LIGO horizon is about redshift 1. I have artificial LIGO detector with sensitivity curve for O2 and O3, and I also have phenom C, phenom D waveform that LIGO is using for detections, and I compare whether my waveform gives me signals to noise ratio greater than 8. So I do full detection procedure. So full evolution of all stars consistent, but only field binaries. I don't do global clusters. Okay, I do that one channel here. So I'll be doing the second thing in next year, global clusters. So, but there'll be full universe then. That's how it's being done.
So if you could generate, I'm sure you can generate similar predictions for the masses, ecosystem.
I will show. So we were supposed to talk about black hole spins, yeah, and masses. So I have a second part about black hole masses, but I don't think we're gonna make it.
So when you do the plots here, you're targeting the masses of LIGO 6?
Yes, because this is done. So look, this is weighted by detection probability.
That's fine, but if going back to Paul's question, if you were to target the high mass X-ray binaries, would you have a different distribution? So I'm now looking at lower mass black holes.
Yes, of course. And the high mass X-ray binaries form through very different channels. Okay. So yes, that you would have very different thing. And all the high mass, okay, not all. 95% of high mass X-ray binaries are in our galaxy, pretty much at one metallicity, because those are young stars. So here it's a mixture of all metallicities for the ages, like over, it's 11 billion of years.
Well, but Chris, because you've been talking about the evolution effectively in isolated stars, at least thus far, low mass X-ray binaries are much closer, in some ways at least, to isolated than it would be if you had a close high mass companion. Right, so you have less tidal torques and so on. Would these models, what would the models predict about the spins of the black holes and low mass X-ray binaries?
Okay, can I get back to, this question is a discussion between single evolutionary models and binary evolutionary models. Can I do the discussion when I,
okay?
Okay?
Yep.
And I will do that. I will give you answer to that.
Okay. So just to be clear, the main difference between these two is that in the right you put in a diffusivity for Taylor's Broadway.
Yes, that's the only difference.
Okay.
You see, red and magenta lines, same kicks, but the only what only changes is Tyler's foot is on, Tyler's foot is off.
Okay.
That's it. Nothing else changes. Okay. And when you look at that plot with Tyler's foot, you see the distributions. Okay. natal ticks are lowering the detection rates. Of course, we disrupt a lot of binaries, but the range stays about the same.
Sorry, I say, keep thinking of the computation. I don't know about these models. I know they are very, very popular people using, but if I take, can I imagine it's hard to add to the Geneva model the Taylor's bird. But it could be perhaps very easy to go to Mesa and turn off.
And we did it, exactly. So, yes. Yes, look, yes, exactly. Look, that's what we did. Mesas, no Tyler's Plot, and it's exactly the same as Geneva.
So that's for these individual ones, but when you put in the binary, that's a different.
I mean, if it's so similar for this model, I'm not going to run a special model, specific model for it. Would be a tiny difference, probably. You know, I'm here about orders of magnitude differences, not about factor of, you know, 2 or 1.5. I don't care. I really care about that type of distribution and changing distribution to something that at least it something that resembles. And I'm not talking about the shape, because of course you can build out of those 10 things, you know, try to test the shape. I'm waiting for another 100 from all three, and then I'll be testing. Now I'm just really trying to get the in a ballpark. So actually, if you talk about shape, what natal kicks do to you? Let's say the average for model with almost no black hole kicks, that red line, the average here is 0.15. But it goes to 0.08 if I give natal kicks. It goes to smaller effective spins because you tend to misalign them. So factor of 2. So I'm already starting to play with the shape. I'm trying to get ready for three results. But here you're just trying to get a ballpark result. Okay. So now let's put the third model. Let's put a fuller model against. I'm going to now forget about this. Let's put this and look at how Jim's models would look like.
Chris,
on the same.
One thing though, before you go. So. The difference, I mean, the angular momentum, you get the kick, but the angular momentum doesn't disappear. At some point, chi p is going to become measurable, right? I mean, it's harder to measure when you're pushing stuff with the high kicks, when you're pushing stuff down, you're pushing it from chi effective into chi p, right?
I'm not
sure. I have many things to say about
chi. Okay, all right, well,
but yeah, with kicks, you definitely go.
Yeah, well, I don't know if you can ever measure.
Yeah, you. So disruption of binary you see with a change of
point. There's a quantity that is defined in phenomenological models of black hole mergers. There's a quantity in binary black hole merger models, phenomenological models that people call chi p. It's supposed to mimic the component of the spins kind of orthogonal in the plane. And right. And this quantity is okay because you can show that it's conserved up to a relatively high cost Newtonian order. It's well defined at least in the spiral and it makes sense to measure it. It drives the spiral. The other quantity is just a phenomenological quantity that is not conserved, that changes on time scales over which I don't think it even makes sense to ask the question, can I measure it?
But well, not the number of the pi, but I'm just saying you should at some point be able to measure some of the precession.
Yes, you should. Yes.
Yeah, I'm not saying yes. Your chi p is 0.6. I'm saying right. The precession component.
No, the precession effects should become measurable at some point, yeah. And that's a very different story. Yeah. We'll probably talk about it next week. But,
then it become more evident for those chi p models. Yeah.
In fact, it's better if you go back in time because you have more precessional cycles and you can measure a lot of things.
So then you can get that information.
Yeah, right. Okay. So low mass binaries are better for that.
Okay. So we're living general.
I have a question. So all of these collapse models, they don't really follow the collapse all the way down to the formation of a black hole. So you have to stop at some point, and then you say, okay, the angular momentum of the star at this point is whatever it is, and then I propagate it down somehow. So the question is, what do you do at that point?
I'm using end of a helium core helium burning, and whatever specific angular momentum I have, I collapse into black hole. There's a very short lifetime after a core helium burning.
So you mean that the specific angular momentum is conserved?
The angular momentum within some mass.
Within some mass, yes. And that mass is a helium core at the end of core helium burning. So it's pretty much 95% of the star lifetime. We're not doing the last, you know, few percent of star lifetime. So we don't go through oxygen burning, silicon burning, which that's a valid point. It may change things.
And some of those, all that, it doesn't change things.
Though. Yeah, it doesn't. So you can push some of those models farther, and some of those models were pushed farther for consistency check, and some things can change, but not by much.
The assumption is that the time scale for alloying and transport is not going to be much longer than the remaining there of the lifetime, which is about 1,000 years.
Okay.
So it's a very short time scale.
Okay. For neutron stars, you have to be more careful because those are forming out of the iron core, and that part of the star is still evolving. So then I think you do have to evolve those models, at least to level carbon burning or something, if you really want a good prediction of neutron stars.
So what I'm hearing is that everybody pretty much agrees that there is not an assumption we should be worried about too much.
For black holes, I wouldn't worry about it too much.
But for neutron star, it's different.
Which part of the star actually falls into the black hole? What's the mass cut between what falls in and what gets expelled?
I worry about everything.
Is the helium core supposed to be expected to be turbulent?
Mm-hmm. Mattel, would you help?
During core collapse, there is turbulence all the way down. I think that's more important to decide which part of the star actually falls into the black hole.
And we don't know.
People are looking to that question. The fact of turbulence on, explosion. But for the angular momentum, most of the angular momentum is in the bulk of the rotation of the core, and so adding some turbulence is not
for black holes, most of the angular momentum is going to be in the helium part of the core.
As long as that gets vectored in. But the turbulence, it depends on whether the turbulence grows or decays, actually.
That's not going to change your angular momentum.
Yeah, that's not going to change the total angular momentum unless it redistributes angular momentum through the star somehow.
Yeah. But in binaries, you don't have envelopes, so you're keeping that mass. You can just keep it core. So you can redistribute it any way you want it, but if you collapse that entire thing into black hole, you're not going to change much.
So I think that the point here is that maybe turbulence participating in the alloying is trapped angular momentum, and I think the only way will be through waves at that point. Potentially that's absurd.
Okay, I know there's we can I mean I don't mind, we can talk about caveats, but if you, so we're adding the third, look same plots, don't look at the dashed lines right now, look at the solid lines. That's the same plot I showed before, that's a standard model with MESA, same observations, but now I'm adding one more model, which is GIMS. You see the distributions, same physics. The only changes is that each black hole that forms get a spin of 0.01. Okay? And you see, of course, the distribution is narrower.
Wait, sorry. If each one is 0.01, then you can't have the Chi effect of that line.
Yes, you can. Because, first of all, some black holes are getting nadir kicks, so cosines are changing. And also, you have accretion of mass onto black hole that spins the black hole up. In binary stars. I promise that I'm gonna do that point connection to binary on this slide. So you're right, yeah. So I should start explaining those things. That's how I wanted to make that point when I bring tides in. But before I go into those details, I just want you to look at qualitatively those two figures. So they both seem to be kind of consistent with data, definitely way, way better than Geneva models. Question is, if this is maybe a bit too narrow, here you know, seems like that event, but it's only 90% credible limit, and with those chi effects are so not really easily measurable.
Let me channel Davide, who's not here. Some of the reason why this is so narrow is that you are doing the, I start like this and I go down like this, propagation from the formation of the binary black holes to the merger.
Yep.
But if you were to do the full precessional dynamics,
no, then it would give you even more narrow. Because then, right now, all the spins are aligned and adding up.
Only if you assume that they're all aligned.
No, spins are not aligned. Sorry, spins are not aligned here. Spins are aligned. Initial is aligned. Yeah. Spins are getting misaligned by nadir kicks, and then black holes are getting spun up by accretion, and also stars are getting spun up by tides.
So what I'm trying to say here is that you should not just assume that the Higgs misaligns these things. You should do a full post-Newtonian propagation of the spins from the moment you get the supernova Higgs to partially misalign them all the way down to when you detect them. And we're not doing it.
I'm definitely not doing that. I don't care. That's a long process. Maybe that's what needs to be done.
I mean, it's not going to change. It's not going to spread it out to plus or minus 0.7.
No.
It's not going to make it a delta function. It's going to be something like that.
Yeah.
So
I
understand the word.
Let me go to that. So I ask you just to look that's the next point. When they finish.
If you start with random orientations initially, and you just make that distribution essentially like that, wouldn't you roughly expect that, you know, following the post-Newtonian evolution, that you would roughly also get something like that?
Because if you start with random orientations, you end up with random orientations, but you're not starting with random orientations. You're starting with partial alignment. Right. And so partial alignment means that whatever is more aligned tends to be more aligned, and whatever is not evolves in a different way. Yeah.
But if your initial
and you have to do it properly.
But if your initial spins are 0.1 or 0.05, you can't.
No. Yeah.
Yeah, you cannot do much.
Yeah. The magnitude of the spins, of course, if you start with small, you start with small. And also all of the precessional effects that I'm talking about become less relevant. So I agree with Cole that it's not going to change things too much, but it could change things a bit.
Okay. So now let's go to binary effects. So let's say, I'm not claiming that, but let's say we think this is a bit too narrow. Okay. What would we want to do actually, like, to spread this out? Okay. What I haven't included involves solid lines. Was my basic models. I didn't include tidal interactions on to spin up the star. In my channel, when I form two black holes, I start wide out, so stars don't interact tidally. Only after common envelope, when one star is already black hole, and the second star already lost its envelope in common envelope in mass transfer, it becomes wolf star. It comes very close to black hole. And if it's very, very close, it may get tidally spun up to almost maximum speed, like 600 kilometers per second, you know, like close to breakup velocity.
And it's tidally locked.
Yeah, it's tidally locked, yes. So actually, I have prescriptions from Matthias Zaridaga from Princeton, from Donor Kushner from Israel, when they actually calculated that type of process for exactly the black hole and Wolf-Rayet binaries. And I know synchronization time scale for Wolf-Rayet star. I know Wolf-Rayet star lifetime from my simulations, and I do that. And about 30% of my binaries, which is, you know, to make two black holes about 30, 40 solar masses to merge within Hubble time, they need to be within 50 solar radii. Okay? But to give you a scale, sense of scale, to get tidal locking, you need to be within 20 solar radii. So it's about 20-30% of my binaries are subject to that. And I'm going to do the trick. I'm going to show the maximal effect of that thing when the Wolf-Rayet star, which is note here as WR, when the Wolf-Rayet star is subject to tidal interactions, I just spin it up maximal, and I say a spin, no matter what model I'm using, is 1. It's somewhere between that value, that initial value from single stellar evolution and 1. Stassos Fragos did a careful study. I didn't implement that. I just say it's 1. So I'm showing maximal effect. So those are, dashed lines. So they spread both models, both GIMS and, you know, MESA model. They put you barely see it, but this is logarithmic scale. That main peak stays, but about, you know, you lose the very tip of the peak and sends it to, you know, to a new peak, which is about centered at 0.5, because you spin up only one star. Okay, here as well. So you can have about 30%. Of mergers, if the tidal spin up is as effective as people claim. If it's less effective, then the peak will be smaller. So that gives you maximum effect. You have a couple of systems that have one. Sometimes you have two. You have a channel that two stars go into double common envelope, they form two Wolf-Rayet stars next to each other, and they both spin up each other. So that's, you know, for those who are interested. So you have ways to spin to spread it out. Accretion onto black hole doesn't do much.
So if I look at the scale, the fraction of binaries that would be in the second peak is
30%, 20-30%. In the entire peak.
So you might still be consistent.
I mean, statistics of small numbers is a very delicate thing, but if the high mass X-ray binary speed measurements are correct,
so I'm
100% of those we know, which are 3, have a very high speed.
Okay, so now let me, and then we can go to Lomax X-ray binaries. Yeah. Okay, so there's a very simple explanation to that, very simple. And it's not mine, so full credit to Tasos Fragos. Full. Let me start with that channel, and then I will go to high-mass extra binaries. So let's say we have Mace or Jinx models that kind of removes angular momentum very quickly from the star. My stars are far apart. They don't tidally interact when they are big. They only interact potentially tidally at the very end. Okay? But probably they don't really tidally interact. So you remove angular momentum from the star, you collapse the black holes, you have low spins. High mass extra binaries could form a very different way. So instead of being 1,000 solar radii apart, those two stars, for high mass extra binary, you add 100 solar radii. And when a star that will make a black hole that you observe in high mass extra binary is going through main sequence, it expands a bit, factor of 2, depending on the model which you want to use. It fills its Rossch lobe, and it gets tidally locked to this massive companion. You remove angular momentum, as with Mesa or Jim's model, but you keep it tidally locked at that closed binary, almost at a breakup velocity. And when you go from main sequence, you have a helium star that very quickly collapses to black hole. And you have a spin of 0.9 or 1, and a nearby companion, like you see. That's the explanation. Different formation channel.
We don't know that their high mass extra binaries have high spins, right?
That's right. So then the ultimate outcome might be, okay, the spin measurements are wrong, but I'm just taking this.
Yeah. But there are at least three system signals X1 with a. Well, I wouldn't call it measurement. I would call it estimate. We know, distance, the masses of those two stars, and people estimate this black hole spin, and it seems to be 0.99.
Yeah.
Greater. It seems to be.
Yeah. But
it's an estimate. Yeah.
This is a matter that I've actually looked into quantitatively. And in every binary spin estimate, the assumption is made that any emission from the disk, whether it's thermal or K-alpha, has a surface brightness profile which rises vertically exactly at the ISCO, and then tapers off with some sort of power law. Now, the ISCO is a characteristic scale. The disks don't just poof go away.
Like people say, in the accretion community, we don't believe those spin measurements.
And so you'd expect that the actual peak in the surface brightness be somewhere near the ISCO. There might be a little outside, it might be a little inside. And of course, that introduces a sizable systematic error into those spin estimates.
But the size, how much is the size? Would it change the 0.99 to 0.3? No, it would change from 0.99 to 0.9.
It's not so clear.
Okay.
I'll just say that the specific calculations of based on actual relativistic MHD simulation models and post-processing are actually literally chunking, being cooked in the computer. They are running as we speak. A student whose thesis defense will be in about 6 weeks, and he's ready.
But so here we argue that if they were sufficiently close to begin with, then you can end up with these high speeds.
Yes.
When we also have that situation in rise of binary black holes, it seems that light would see, and we still don't see those high speeds.
Let's assume for a second that those three high-mass extra binaries have high spin, okay? Let's just for a second. I checked the future evolution when we evolve them forward, none of them makes a double black hole. So like I wouldn't see that.
In these ones, if you take these ones because we run out of time.
But No. I put them anywhere in the universe. I'm just saying, no matter what time, the fate of each of those three high mass extra binaries is either a merger, so you form a single star, because the companion expands and the common envelope already short orbit, they merge, or if you can avoid common envelope, but then you lose some mass anyway, you form those 20 solar mass stars, so most likely they will form neutron stars, kick will disrupt, or you form a black hole neutron star binary. But if you go again with you guys, and you let's say for a second, high mass extra binaries do have low spins, there are also formation channels that do produce high mass extra binaries from white orbits. You need then common envelope instead of tidal locking. So there are both channels, so both options are on the table, and evolution can explain both. So basically, we cannot answer which one is true, in other words, but those observations or lack of them are not, telling that evolution is totally wrong or something. Okay. So now, Lama, sorry.
Can I make a comment? So I have tried to make some high-mass X-ray binaries using my angular momentum transport description and tides. and I still tend to get small spin for the black hole. Now, I haven't explored the full parameter space of binaries, but I'm still getting pretty slow spins. It's hard. It's a little hard for me to understand.
So okay. So the Tassos claim was for that model. So Tassos was starting with higher spins. So he was not using your model, he was using that.
That's right.
So sorry, that claim that I made an argument about high black hole spins tidal spin up was done with this model. Tassos done with, not with Jim's model. And he claims that he can get entire range all the way to, from, you know, whatever natal spin is with Mesa, all the way to one. It's published. It's an UpJ paper. So I'm not an expert. Somebody would help here.
Should not be much. No. And Jean-Pierre Lazotte worked on this in the 90s.
You could spin down from like 0.99 to 0.9 or something.
Okay, so it wouldn't matter here, I see.
They're sort of an analogous. If you have those magnetic fields in spin, there is angular momentum carried off in the jet. But in addition, the magnetic fields also couple the rotation of the black hole to material in the disk. And that's, there are estimates in the literature that are pretty rough, that it looks like if you can come to an equilibrium at a spin that's sort of 0.9-ish.
Sorry, I'm talking so much, I need some water. Sorry, guys. Cole, your question, Lama Sextree binary. So we already talked about high Lama Sextree. Oh, so.
So, if the assumption that all this black holes of form century, they're practically non-spinning.
Yeah, modulo of these ones if tides are operating.
So how do you explain long memory bursts? How do you explain collapse hours? It's good
that
we have Andrew here because he's
a nice person. So you do similar with high mass extra binaries. Well, first of all, you do have options to spin them up by tides.
So you assume that the collapse hours are all in binaries essentially?
No, I'm not assuming that. No. I don't. I didn't ask that question, so I don't know yet. So I'm answering as you know. Yeah, but rotation is induced by a companion, is it, right? So it's binary.
No, you can have a star loop and the wave starts spinning rapidly and stays compact. So the trick is, angle-momentum transfer is still efficient, but you never build like an envelope. The envelope is mixed into the core during the sequence. So if the star never expands, there's no way for the star to the core to spin down. So if the muscles is low, you can keep the core rotating rapidly until the core collapses.
But you agree that this is one scenario. Another one, you keep the rotation through binary companion.
Sure.
So you can do both.
So this requires.
But are we talking about the same order of magnitude for masses, essentially like 30 or 40 solar masses? And then if that's the case, we are talking about the same masses. Why do you have a different evolution in one?
Because of initial separation. If you start here, it's a very different version than here.
But the point is that you can actually have not a binary, so we can have it as an isolated star. I'm sure. Trying to understand what's the difference between the evolutions.
So London reverse is 1/3,000 supernovae, so it's pretty rare channel evolution for a single star or potentially not. And the requirements are high mass, large deletion rate, however, you get it through binary interaction for a single star, high mass, that doesn't matter. And finally, global phasing. So that that's usually the reason why we believe this is a pretty exotic channel of formation. That's where the theory stands right now.
That's what I found as well. It's hard to make rapid spins unless you either have the homogeneous evolution or tidal spin up. It goes the way you can do it.
So now Cole's question, let me reiterate and see if I understood you correct, if I remember correct. So Cole is saying that maybe we should also look not only at high mass X-ray binaries, which are closer in mass to LIGO sources, but we should look at low mass X-ray binaries, which is like a 0.6, 0.5 solar mass M dwarf, enter black hole, those are black hole transients. And black holes are between 5 and 15. In our galaxy, it's about 20 of them. Okay, and those have also similar spin, I won't call it measurement estimates, but those span a wide range from small spins to high spins. They're all over. And some actually measurements for one system show low spin or high spin, depending whether you use K alpha or fitting a disk. Okay, so keep that in mind. I think actually that those systems are, so did I translate your question correctly? I think actually that those systems could be farther away from LIGO sources, those black holes, than high mass X-ray sources. And for the following reasons, in terms of spin, in those low mass X-ray binaries, at least there are claims. I don't know how they form. In population synthesis, we cannot, in those evolutionary studies, we cannot reproduce them. We always, we're off with masses or off with orbital periods or so, or numbers, something always is wrong. So this is an embarrassment. We've, people tried it for many, many years. It's embarrassment. Those are pretty much, yeah. We try a bunch of papers, we cannot reproduce them. We will get period, but not mass. We get mass, we don't get period. We get both, we don't get numbers. We get numbers 100 times smaller than we see. I mean, when the numbers are estimated, those are going out, the duty cycles are short. Anyway, I think when in Lamas X-ray binaries, at least people proposed that, Filip Pochodowski and others, that you could actually start with stars of similar mass, and you form a low-mass black hole out of 20 solar mass star, and you have a 10, 15 solar mass companion, and you start stripping that companion. Keep stripping, keep stripping in sequence, keep rejuvenating, and you go to one solar mass or so. And then you have a those, they could live for 10 billion years in our galaxy. You could be feeding the powering of the black hole, and you could actually feed it up more than it weighs. So you can actually spin it up from zero to full spin, to one. That's, let's say, Tasso Stragos and McClintock claims. I don't fully believe those channels because I rather find that the origin, most stars are companion, most stars are like one solar mass stars, 0.6, 0.7. So I don't think you can, and those stars don't look that weird, like those KM dwarfs that you see as a companion to black holes, they don't look like some really weird stars that were stripped from 10 solar masses down to 0.5. So actually, I don't think that this is the case, but that at least the claim on the market. And since I cannot reproduce those systems, I cannot make really any big claims here.
Right. So it's an intriguing prospect, obviously. So essentially, what you're saying is that a lot of the mechanisms for spin up may exist in LMXBs because they weren't always low mass companions. But in terms of the mass transfer, are you talking about one of them forming a black hole with a companion that at that moment has 10 solar masses? That then transfers 9 solar masses.
Mm-hmm. That's what, it's not my proposals, well, yes, exactly. And they, of course, ignore any Eddington limits and okay. Yeah, as they put 100%, yes. So to get that, you need to do that. When I put limits, I don't, so that's Tasso Stragos McClintock paper, I redone that study when I didn't put Eddington limit because we know we can break Eddington limit, but I put, you know, there's a logarithmic scale that you can go above Eddington limit and you slowly shutting down accretion as you go, but you can go 100 Eddington, no problem. And you don't, it's hard to produce a lot of highly spinning low mass X-ray binaries, black holes, highly spinning black holes.
Now that picture does entail a population of very bright high mass X-ray binaries for the time that the star that began at 10 solar masses is shedding 90% of its mass to the other black hole. And whether it's going at super Eddington or just at Eddington or anywhere, it ought to be really bright.
Yes, and I don't think we are. Like we said, we only see those really low-going transients. The problem is, you know...
And you know how many there should be, because we know how many low-mass X-ray binaries there are, and we need to make them.
Yeah, but we're talking only the proposal. It's not my proposal, so I'm actually critical of that because I don't find that possible.
How does he answer the question?
Oh, they don't. They don't. They also don't answer the question about breaking the Eddington limit and letting all the mass go in. They don't. They don't.
So just going back to...
But people do cite that paper all the time. Sorry.
Going back to the other possibility, let's suppose that's not what's going on. Let's suppose that the current low-mass X-ray binaries containing black holes had a very massive star and something that started at one solar mass. In that circumstance, is it fair to believe that the high-mass star evolves like an isolated star, and therefore that we would expect that the spins would in fact be low?
Yes. Correct.
So we can be sure that the tides from this relatively low mass object are insufficient to give it enough rotation to collapse to a high
correct.
Rotation.
Correct.
Are you sure about that? Because a lot of those might have gone through common envelope. They might have then you would have a helium star inside your one solar mass star. The helium star could still be tidally spun up.
But helium star is 10, 20 solar masses. How would you use that one solar mass star to spin it up?
It depends on the orbital separation, but it could still, maybe 20 might be pushing it, but if it's close enough, it should have enough angular momentum to spin up the 10 solar mass helium star.
Okay, I haven't looked into that issue.
I mean, it depends on the orbital period that we observe the low mass X-ray binary at. Those are usually like a quarter a day.
Well, there are things like one of them high spin has a period of a month.
Okay, so that I think would be very challenging to explain.
But you know what, VOS, let's say GRS-1915, which is about a month, is expanding because because if you transfer mass from lower mass star to, so it may have been much closer at some point.
Well,
but not that close probably.
That much closer.
Yeah.
What's the revolution? But since, for example, this chemically homogeneous channel has been already invoked for some other mechanisms, hasn't been explored at all in this case, could it play a role? Yeah. I mean, that's a believable mechanism to produce a black hole with high spin without, you know, needing accretion or tidal lock or stuff like that. Has been explored at all.
Pablo Marchand, that would be great.
Well, Ilya Mandel, Selma Deming, Pablo Marchand, there is...
But on the mass X-ray.
Yeah.
Right, I was talking about this problem.
Yeah,
no, ah, not for low mass X-ray binaries, I guess. If low mass, that's Pablo. So if anyone done it for low mass X-ray binaries, that would be Pablo, probably.
I think it's hard to spin it up enough to have the homogeneous evolution channel with the low mass containment. Yeah. But it might be possible, I'm not sure.
So there was something besides that. Chemical homogeneous evolution only happens, occurs above a certain mass of the mass of stars. So now you want to make low mass black holes,
right,
a bit in trouble because your window opportunity just becomes very small. Also, you know, these are like local systems, so I'm at least the
that's also doesn't work there.
So we'll be pushing it.
But
are we converging in the direction that to me it seems like if you look at masses and spins, you know, the population of high mass X-ray binaries and the population observed by LIGO seems
different.
I think to me it's
you cannot prove it yet.
Right?
You know. But it exactly, it seems that.
So that double peak emission, so that would be still consistent with current observations, right? Because of the...
Totally. Both, if you use Wolf-Rayet-Tite, which are most likely, you know, we should be operating, and I check synchronization timescales, both distributions are totally, you know, consistent with what LIGO is seeing. And you know, we should be, the thing is, this is maximal peak I could get. It probably should be spread out over, you know, it should be more like a tail. When I give it, instead of assuming that the black hole coming out of a Wolf-Rayet star is always spinning at one, if I give it distribution like, you know, Tassos is calculating with his students, then I will have a tail, so it would be more smoother distribution.
There's a few things that, I mean, I don't know exactly how we would use this plot, but I see that you only have one model, so it's a very specific,
So of course, you can, there's a lot of knobs and things that you can change. This is the standard physics that I pretty much, my intuition tells me should work. But I wouldn't be putting my ears, we can change a lot of things, masses.
What I'm saying is, yeah, exactly. So this is just calculated with one mass.
No. This is all the entire IMF from, you know, from like I'm starting at 5 solar masses going to 150 solar masses. So maybe not entire IMF, but it's a kind of black hole formation range. IMF is assumed to be power law minus 2.3. All metallicities, evolution, all the stars are until redshift 15, pop 1, pop 2. I checked pop 3. It doesn't make much of a difference. It's 1% addition from pop 3 stars. So I'm not including them. I have that done, but I didn't want to, you know, mix the picture.
So according to this model, I mean, if you, let's say, measure, so a prediction, well, I guess, an expectation would be if you measure like a high effective spin in a LIGO binary, then if you do those plots where you just constrain the spin on the individual black holes,
it will always be the case that one is low and the other is high, right?
No. Here, in that scenario, you know, I find some systems that it's two Wolf-Rayet stars are very close. I can spin both of them up.
Well that's one per
exactly. But thousand. But then I don't consider homogeneous evolution channel here. So we'd go to what right. Matteo was saying, and that channel. Then I would claim that yes, it's not coming from me, but it's the same process.
Right.
But it just you start. You know, here you just bring that by common envelope. Homogeneous channels works from slightly different parameter space. Instead of starting 1,000 solar radii apart and bringing the common envelope, you start very close, but you both stars are keeping spinning each other.
Right. Right.
And so that's not included here.
Rose favor and higher mass, and so Alberto's point is to still stand if you get a low mass binary and they're both spinning up. Both sides spinning.
That would be hard to find.
Yeah.
Okay. But if I see like a typical LIGO masses like 20, 30, and both of them highly spinning, I would be betting that it's probably homogeneous channel.
Okay.
And especially if aligned as well, you know, because then if you have high spins, probably you can measure the misalignment, is that right? At least hope for that with population of them. I mean, with population of those. Yeah. One thing that I don't include that may actually affect things, I include accretion onto black hole. But since it involves high mass stars, there's not much of accretion. In common envelope, it's a Bose shock, it's 1% Bondi Hoyle. You accrete on 30 solar mass black hole, you accrete about one solar mass. Not important. I include accretion from winds, that's less than solar mass. And sometimes from Roche or flow to black hole. But it's very quickly because the companion to black hole is massive and it goes on thermal timescale. It's very quick. And we eject a lot because it's highly, highly over Eddington. But what I don't include is that when I have two stars that are unevolved, main sequence, let's say some core helium burning star, they transfer mass between each other. And even, you know, 10% accretion of a star's mass can spin it up to breakout velocity. So then I would need to move my models, which are rotating, initial models for black hole spins rotating at 400 kilometers per second, I would need to move them to 600 kilometers per second. But that, I haven't done that, but I need to ask people, you know, I showed you the change from one line, purple to red line, it's changed from 100 kilometers per second to almost 400 kilometers per second. I would need to do one line for 600, 650 and check that it's the same. I haven't done that check. But I'm not including that in my simulation. So I don't spin up stars as I go in binary evolution and some of them get significant accretion in the evolution. So that is not included here. But that's a we have, like Matteo was saying, we have a lot of, like you guys were saying, we don't really know how you collapse things to black hole. It's direct through disk, how quickly. Actually, if for most massive stars above 40, I assume that, like I was saying, telling you that anti-helium core goes into the black hole, but we don't know that. We really don't.
Is there any prospect to get an angle on that from simulators just too hard?
What is the size of the helium core? If you...
Few solar radii, up to 20 maximum. It's pretty compact.
No, just that, I mean.
How much is your, what is your patience?
Well, what if maybe if you decouple simulations?
I mean, the only way would be to do a Newtonian simulation that you trust up to a certain regime and then take over with a relativistic simulation. So that's the only way.
Well, but where are we in Corpo La Supernova? I mean, I think you're going to be dead by the time we begin moving somewhere. I mean, Corpo La Supernova, to get to a point where we really trust what's going on, it's going to take a long time.
Yeah, but I mean, this is it's supposed to be direct collapse in this case. You're not going to worry about, you know, bounces and code.
That's it. You're supposed to be, that's...
Yeah, that's supposed to be, that's an assumption,
answer.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
But it's okay when you have time to make the simplest possible
assumptions. Yeah. And I'm not going to have time to do masses, but I have models with masses, and then actually same plots for masses look, you know.
Yeah, we have 10 minutes.
Do you guys want to change the subject and show you one plot with masses?
Yeah.
That's like an hour-long discussion.
We should keep it, Alberto, maybe we should have a separate discussion in some other week. On
maybe
going back to this question, would be interesting. Obviously, sure, you know, like numerical simulation, full three dimension of this problem probably out of reach. But the interesting aspect of this is that you have a grasp of the total angular momentum that you have available, and you want to know what's the final angular momentum that's going to be in the newly formed object. So I think that even in one dimension, you can make some order of magnitude estimate of, you know, given the available time scale that you have, how much angle momentum can you transport out of your or your size. So there's definitely some limits that you can put. And I think in general, what we find is that it's very, very hard to find a process which is so efficient at extracting, you know, either from a minimally spinning case, like, you know, models that Jim has, or a model like the Geneva case, where you, they don't include the telesprit, and then you have huge amounts of angle momentum. But still, if you want to extract that, you know, you have all the unlimited amount of time, you can only come up with a certain amount of processes that can do the job. And most of the time, this operates on longer time scale than even available.
Well, one example we can operate extremely fast is GR. So GR can do that for you. So you have your core rotating very fast.
Yeah.
And you're forming a black hole that is maximally rotating. It's going to get rid of everything else, or it's going to give you a singularity.
Right. So
that's why I was asking these details. And how do we know? Is it everything gets formed at the same time, or do we form a small one and then begin to accrete to get larger? And this would make a huge difference.
So you would think about stability, dynamic instability that, you know,
this core is close to the magnitude, there's many common black hole with the useful conjecture argument. That we have a small region at the origin that has enough mass in a small enough region to form a black hole and has lost primary momentum. If that's is violating the curve bound, it's going to get the hell out of that.
Is there a way to make some estimate of what are the conditions for this to happen?
There are some, but in a completely different context. People are thinking of this in the context of dark matter. Where that the dark matter where a model falls into the center of a new star or a star and then it collapses to a black hole and then it needs to grow. And there are lots of different estimates, and some people are claiming you can get all the way to high speeds, and others have very strong doubts about that.
But can you really you'd think that this is something that you could set up just a toy model within a numerical relativity code and solve. But is the problem initial data or hertz?
No, it's a problem. So this one I'm talking about is the different scale. So what size do you start? So is that where you satisfy this in the Hooke conjecture, is it large enough or is it very tiny? And then it's just multiple scales.
Sure. But you could just lay it on the grid with a size of 5 or 10 m. And
sure, that you could do. Is it realistic? I don't know.
But you might learn something about the conceptual issue.
Yeah.
You know, for example, is there some process that you automatically get rid of the angular momentum in the gravitational radiation?
Sure.
Well, if it's magnetic, there's no gravitational radiation losses.
Yeah. Angular momentum.
So maybe there's an
employee. you need to break the
angular momentum. I mean, it's 3D. You put the magnetic
field in the
Just for GR, can you really get the spin low? I mean, if you start with spin of 1, I understand. It'll spin down.
Different scales,
but will it really spin down to 0.1? It'll just go to 0.9 or something, right? Yeah, so I think it's really hard.
So it depends how much you start. But then I think we can call the volume at 1.5, it comes down again.
Let's try to keep a single line of this guy. I just killed all the lights.
So to wrap up, just to understand, is it possible, you know, to take, you know, like a even initial, because obviously initially you have this extended core, GR is not important. You can take, you know, like a simulation of even 1D, you know, and get down to the point where you can map one of the where the scales allow you to do a simulation and maybe check order of magnitude how much angle momentum we're gonna lose in the process. So maybe that's something that's nobody's done it that far.
We're doing it in the different parts of wavelengths and two wavelengths in the different context trying to figure out matter core, but there are lots of similarities.
Yeah, sure. I mean, it seems to be worried about this mapping from, you know, the 1D simulation to the...
So I don't know what we're talking about here. I just want to understand a little better. So if you are talking about dark matter core, I guess what you're really trying to do is you take two blobs of scalar field, you collapse the two blobs of scalar field.
No, I think there's enough scalar field in the core of neutrons.
So you form a black hole at the center. The tiny black
I think he's trying to violate the curve bound somehow. But how do you? Well,
no, it's a different. We're talking about.
I see people, but blobs of scalar field people here don't react very well. So. Okay.
I have a question about the data.
The error bars are statistical and systematic. What happens when you combine lots of the black hole mergers? Do you just see the systematics and the distribution doesn't change? Or will it really get sharp with many observations?
Well, it depends what the underlying distribution is. This isn't all one kind of system, necessarily.
Yeah, and you end up with these populations being dominated by the loudest, most interesting event. And when you do the, when you look at these papers, I've always looked at large-scale predictions for spins with the population simulations. I know people have looked at individual, how could we measure, you know, 0.99 spin, how accurately could you measure how accurate the precession, precession, but I don't know if anyone's done a large-scale population synthesis, basically taking this type of stuff, running it through, and saying how accurate you could get if you had 1,000 mm-hmm. measures.
At the end of 03 with 100 events, how narrow?
With the sensitivity that LIGO has during 03, I think the typical error on each of the chi effective measurements is about 10%.
It's going to be statistically
10% or 0.1?
0.1, well, it's.
Well, because if it's actually 0.1, 10% is 0.01. So the delta effective spin is about 0.1.
But I've seen those error bar outcomes equal to zero.
Yes, statistically, that's very close
to zero.
You
could
get a factor
on
a couple
of them.
Is that just because you're going to see characteristically things that approaching the boundaries against noisy claim?
That's one of the most volume.
This distribution is consistent with chi-effective being identically zero in all systems?
No, there is one here, at least 90%, that's not crossing zero. But it's 90%. Yeah.
But there's two others.
No, that's the only one, I think.
15, 12, 26 is also out. Yeah.
Oh, yeah, there's
actually,
this one?
Yeah, the most massive and the least massive are not compatible with zero.
Coincidence?
But the thing is that both, did you guys, Baba, both positive, is the child that both on positive side, and that's where both distributions are.
Systematic. One is at the threshold of detectability, so.
So again, the error of the system.
No, both are on the right.
Okay.
No, yeah. Not yet, but if you have 20 instead of 2, that will become important. Yeah. So, you know, it's not important statistically right now, like you say, but both of them are on the positive side. If you have 20 of them on the positive side, both of those distributions have an average or medium on the positive side.
The
Princeton guys would be right in that peak. Is that right?
All the other ones are around zero. One, I think, maybe towards the left.
Oh, I see.
All the
so I have a LIGO people on the paper. I don't think they want me to put, but we should. Yeah. All right, well, let's do it. Then we can do it. Yeah. Well, Dan is not yet here. And how many LIGO new black holes? 20 right now?
I have to check. There's like 14.
I thought it's more like 20 of them. Can we get any idea of the effective spins or not yet? We have to wait for publication.
Well, yeah, I mean, officially, yeah, I think we're supposed to just wait for them. So that's not going to be like the end of 03 for publication.
Yeah, it will be half, is that right? But could you tell us anything about effective spins?
Are you
should I?
We can close the room.
Well, it's almost 11. I think it's.
On that note.
Right. So is everybody happy with? So we can get
the. Well, I'm still here for a few more weeks. I'm still here for a few more weeks. So if someone wants to chat with me, so, you know.
Is there any final remarks you want to make?
No.
I just. Awesome, Chris.
Okay. Remark.
Thank you.
Thank you.